Hi friends, and here we are again at a treatise on white magic, and this is a video commentary on the rules for the physical plane. We're on program number four in this series, and I've discontinued that larger numbering. So this is page 539, and the rule goes like this. The magician must recognize the four, note in his work the shade of violet they evidence, and thus construct the shadow. When this is so, the shadow clothes itself and the four become the seven. I think we can see here that the four ethers will clothe themselves with matter of the gaseous, liquid, and dense physical levels. Okay, and the two factors to be discussed are the quaternaries to be recognized and precipitation of thought forms. Okay. Now, the Tibetan begins with what may not be exactly an encouraging word to us. He says, this rule is for me one of the most difficult to explain, and the reason for this being threefold. So let's see wherein lies the difficulty. Here I'm just accenting the one, two, and three so we can get oriented properly. All right. The number, he says here that the number of people in physical incarnation at this time who can work in a truly creative manner and profit by the information given in this rule is exceedingly few. I mean, they are those who can precipitate thought forms onto the physical plane by magical methods. The rest of us have pretty much to work with our minds, our brains, our hands and feet. Only to the white magician, and he experienced in this work, can the real interpretation be given. And this is one of the places where he is with judiciously withholding information, which will be given to us when the time is right. When we pursue this path of occultism, it is necessary to have patience. There is much danger in imparting the significance of these rules to those who are not qualified in themselves to work correctly. So he's really, you know, walking a razor edge path here. He wants to get the information out, but not give too much that would cause chaos and disruption and harm not only the user of the rules, but others as well. We will therefore consider the qualifications required of those who are entitled to this knowledge so that the student can begin to develop in himself what may be lacking. Certainly it's not by begging that we will receive the knowledge, but we have to qualify ourselves. Okay. Okay, number two. And why is it difficult for him to explain? That's what we're doing. Let's just say reasons why it is difficult to explain these rules. So this particular rule, why? Okay, let's put this. Reasons why it's difficult to explain this particular rule. I imagine none of them is easy. Number two, the danger of minute and detailed instructions consists in the fact that were they now to be given to the world, we should be flooded with thought forms, and these thought forms would be created in order to express purely selfish desire, and mental matter would be swept into activity in line with the fancies and the whims of the undeveloped along spiritual lines. So this would be the result. People would find the method of precipitating their thought forms. And so many thought forms unsanctioned by the divine plan would surround us, and it would make matters much more congested, much worse, much more difficult. It must be remembered that every human thought, whether the potent mass thoughts or individual dynamic ideas, must eventually emerge objectively on the physical plane. I guess we have to be very careful what it is we think. Okay. That's quite a statement, isn't it? That every human thought, Roberto Assagioli went over this and talked about even the slightest type of precipitation that could arise within the microcosmic system due to a thought, but there would always be a physical externalization, however small it might be. So, every human thought, whether the potent mass thoughts, which carry so much illusion, or individual dynamic ideas, must eventually emerge objectively on the physical plane. And we don't know what eventually actually means, you know, so the timing of this is not given. This is an inevitable and unalterable rule, and due consideration of this law, which governs mental substance, will show the danger of wrong thought and the power of right, presumably power of right thought. So, a precipitation against the divine plan could easily occur, and the forces of obstruction would gain in power. The potency of human thought at this time is primarily of mass description, for few there are who can think creatively. I mean, the mind simply works. We can see that in the way that the throat center is ruled by the earth for the average man, and the fecundity of forms is suggested, and not a careful choice of the forms to be created, and later for disciples, it is Saturn, and at some point the magical Uranus gets into the picture. The potency of a human thought at this time is primarily of mass description. We're talking about mass consciousness and the thought arising from it, or the Kama monastic forms arising from the mass use of Kama Manas. For few there are who can think creatively. Public opinion, mass ideas, the tendencies of human desire and thought are not at this time of the highest order. I guess that's an understatement. And the physical precipitation of these vague and inchoate thoughts, distinguished by a vast similarity and colored by selfish intent and personal behest, and based upon likes and dislikes, prejudices and longings can be seen in the most interesting precipitation. Now this is, here is a warning. and an unusual one. So let's just say the quality is not sufficient to warrant successful or surefire, or what can we say, that which cannot fail, infallible precipitation at the time when the Creator seeks precipitation. Maybe eventually there will be the kind of precipitation as he tells us and warns us. But what is it that has worked out? This is the quality of thought that is at present in the mass consciousness, public opinion, mass ideas, the tendencies of human desire and thought. They're not of the highest order. And the physical precipitation of these vague and inchoate, ill-formed thoughts, distinguished by a vast similarity and colored by selfish intent and personal behest and based upon likes and dislikes, prejudices and longings, can be seen in the following precipitation: the vast assembly of insects which now haunt our planet and cause increasing concern to the scientist, agriculturalist, and all those dealing with the welfare of the human animal, are the direct result of thought precipitation. Now, this must seem really fanciful to many who are not familiar with the occult doctrine. But somehow we are feeding the insect population. We are guaranteeing their overproduction, and they have become an ecological hazard in so many places, including the area of health that involves the spread of disease. I was just reading now where the in Los Angeles at this time, 2018, there's over 100 cases of typhus among people who are deprived, among homeless people, and it is spread by some kind of tiny animal, a flea, something of that nature. And, of course, the Zika virus, which produces microcephalus, I guess it is, the shrinking of the skull, and I suppose the reduction of mental or brain capacity is spread through insects, and there's an overabundance. And crops are ruined. You know, in the Bible we have the ruination of the harvest through plague of locusts. There are many ways in which a balance is not kept due to humanity's misuse of the thought form creating capacity. Unconscious use, we might say. I have not time to enlarge upon this fact, but I can assure you that as men learn to think with more unselfishness and with greater purity, and as malice and hatred and competition give way to brotherhood, kindness, and cooperation, the insect pest, as it is now called, will surely die out. Well, sometimes you look at mosquitoes and other blood-sucking insects, and you wonder whether malice and hatred, simply a tendency to prey upon a host, is not an unconscious motivator. There are many offshoots, interesting items of information that arise in occultism, and here is one which might arouse our incredulity. You know, we're just not going to believe this. But the Tibetan goes out of his way to say, I can assure you that this is so, and when we change the quality of the thought forms we generate, an ecological balance will be restored. I mean, really, at the present time, it seems that humanity is disrupting everything, not thinking of the future, not thinking of the children coming, of future generations, but only thinking of their thinking indulgently of their supposed one short life upon this planet. Okay, now here's another difficulty in elucidating the rules. Another difficulty I experience in elucidating these rules lies in the fact that it is today more easy to prove the fact that there is a realm of mind than it is to prove that there is a realm of ether, even though scientists use the word widely, or at least used to before certain experiments obviated the scientific necessity of an ether, and I think it's still held that there is no need for an ether and that its existence has been disproven. So there are many thoughts and even prejudices against the existence of the ether, which, of course, is so important. The ether is so important in the entire magical process. Okay, so we think of the realm of mind, and it seems somewhat objective. It seems that we can discuss it, analyze it, discuss its various functions and qualities, but not the realm of ether. And we are here dealing with rules for the physical plane, which include that physical area, that subtle physical area we call the ether. This rule concerns the four grades of etheric substance, which constitute the etheric envelope of all forms in nature, from a mountain to an ant, and from a plant to an atom. Certain scientists recognize the fact of an etheric body, and vast numbers do not. And from the standpoint of the masses of humanity, it remains unrecognized. This was 90 years ago, and I think more interest has been aroused, and you see people refocusing their eyes so that they can see the perhaps the etheric counterpart of the dense physical body. Anyway, the very subject of this particular rule is not accepted by the highest scientists. So it appears. That which lies closest to us and in our immediate foreground is often overlooked. That's the point. That part of the physical plane which is subtle, and we call it etheric, is overlooked. And it has interested those of us who teach and guide to note how much emphasis is laid upon psychic and astral phenomena, and how little attention is paid to the more obvious and more easily discerned etheric forms and forces. And of course, the New Age, with its connection to the etheric body via particularly Aquarius and another air sign, Gemini, will focus upon the etheric body, and this especially maybe in the medical field at first. And yet we are not paying attention. Well, now, of course, 90 years later, there is more serious attention paid, at least among avant-garde researchers and medical people, to the existence of an ether, but still, it is not accepted as such in those who are studying the advanced levels of physics, although maybe the particles being discovered now will point to the existence of an etheric level, by whatever name it may be called. Given a slight change in the present mode of visual focusing, I mean, and as I say, some people who promote the recognition of the etheric body, attempt this slight change, a defocusing of the eye, it will be found that the human eye is capable of including an entirely new field of perception and awareness. Now, this, after all, is interesting, and it doesn't sound like that great a change in the focus of the eye. It sounds like something that can be taught to many, and as DK tells us, before long, etheric perception will be quite well recognized. Already there are people who really utilize it, and I know some of them, and they look at you in this way, and it's not a direct look. They look at your body in such a way that they're focusing on something else. Blindly, men introvert their consciousness and become aware of astral objects and that elusive world of ever-changing forms in which we live and move and have our being, and yet they fail to see that which lies immediately before them. So one problem in elucidating this rule number 13 is blindness to the etheric dimension of the physical plane, blindness to it. So it's not believed in, and it's not researched, and it's not pursued, although increasingly among certain types it is registered. I mean, a lot can happen in 90 years or 80 some years since this book was written. So these three difficulties of the lack of qualification of those who might receive the information, dangers inherent in unconscious form building, all kinds of unbalancing precipitations, and etheric blindness, this is what makes it difficult for the Tibetan to explain it, and maybe his explanations would go further today, because there's been a big emphasis upon the esoteric and that which is hidden, normally hidden from the eye. But when he was writing, it says it makes it well nigh impossible for me to do full justice to this rule and to elucidate the work on etheric levels, and hence the relative brevity of the elucidation. Okay, so let's go on. In dealing with the subject of qualification and answering the question, what constitutes the equipment needed by the white magician, because we do have to see whether we measure up to the task, all things are not for all people at the same time, I would say one thing. All students realize that certain requirements must be met if a man is to be entrusted with any measure of understanding of the technique of the great work. Magic is considered magi, the great work. Magic is the great work of creation, really. And to the extent, in our hands, it's more creation rather than self-becoming, as it is for the universal logos. There are always requirements, and in the field of esotericism, these requirements count for a great deal. Always, you know, we have the sorcerer's apprentice syndrome, the assistant to the master, the sorcerer, the magician, who's gets a hold of a few magical phrases and creates havoc because of not understanding the method of application and the wider implications. So there are going to be in the New Age, I'm sure, many deaths and untoward happenings, creation of untoward circumstances due to ignorance of how the magical words and forces which promote precipitation should be used. I take it for granted, however, that the character qualifications are not those to which our question refers. This will, of course, distinguish the white from the black magician. The white magician is of good character and has overcome selfishness to a very great extent. So, you know, in the same way that character qualifications are not the principal means of measuring whether one can pursue the path of discipleship, but more pertain to the path of probation, so in this work of magic, it is assumed that one is, I would say, at least a disciple and has a mental focus, a good, well-stocked mind, the ability to control emotions from the mental level, I would assume. Anyway, we're not talking about character qualifications when we're dealing strictly with the probationary path, as DK says, was done quite a bit in the early theosophical books, then maybe we are talking about character. All aspirants know, and down the ages have been taught, that a clean mind and a pure heart, love of truth and a life of service and unselfishness are prime prerequisites. And where they are lacking, naught avails, and none of the great secrets can be imparted. Well, there it is. So, you know, it's not that we can say, well, I'm a disciple, you know, so I don't have to worry about measuring up. Because by definition, I measure up, but maybe not. Maybe there are some areas which still need to be looked into, because always it's possible to skip over some personal faults which later can prove great obstacles in performing the esoteric work of magic. You might well say here, he says, we have also been taught that there exist those who work in the four ethers and who undoubtedly perform magical deeds, yet who do not possess the essential purity and loving kindness to which reference has been made. This is undoubtedly true. They belong to a group of workers in matter, whom we call black magicians. They are highly developed intellectually and can motivate mental substance or mind stuff in such a manner that it can achieve objectivity on the physical plane and bring about their deep intent. Well, we know, we've been told that there will be a kind of a battle in the Aquarian Age between the strictly mental magicians, which I think is a nice way of saying those who have chosen the left-hand path, and those who are the white magicians and are soul-inspired. About this group, there is much misunderstanding and profound ignorance, but he does say that speculation about them is both profitless, something like that, and dangerous. Is it profitless? It's a word just like profitless, but certainly the word dangerous is there. So about this group of workers in form, there is much misunderstanding and profound ignorance. It is perhaps as well for their destiny is tied up with the future race, the sixth, and their end, and the cessation of their activities will come about in that far distant eon, which is technically called the sixth round. This is interesting, because supposedly, then, after the judgment day, sometimes it's a little difficult to know regarding the judgment day whether he's talking about rounds within our particular planetary scheme, or our particular chain, or larger types of rounds which go from chain to chain. But anyway, the number five is deeply involved in some millions of years occur before our planet will be entirely inhabited by a humanity, all of whom are on the spiritual path. So that's very interesting, and something that I had, their activities will come, their end, at least influencing our planet, and the cessation of activities will come about in that distant eon. Notice how around is an eon. This is a good time to note it, I would say. Okay. And I'm going to put that down. Note that a round is called an eon or aeon, however you choose to pronounce it. The judgment day will occur in relation to the number five and the ridding of the planet, whether it's our planetary chain or more probably the planet as a whole, from the predations of the Black Lodge in the sixth round, either a chain round or a scheme round. We're not sure which here, but I would say a chain round is much closer in its occurrence, because we are now in the fourth chain round, in our fourth chain, but we're also in the fourth scheme round for our entire planetary scheme. And it'll take a long time before we reach the sixth scheme round. As to the particulars of those kinds of things, I don't think we know enough to lay them out, but that there are two different kinds of rounds, one much shorter than another, that I think we can successfully infer from what we've been given. The final break or division between the so-called black and white forces for this particular world cycle, and we wonder what that is this in relation to our planet or to the solar system? So is this distinguishing, is a world cycle a, over here. So is a world cycle a scheme round? Or is it something even bigger, having to do with the kinds of rounds that are experienced from planet to planet in a solar system? Or is a world cycle the incarnation of a solar logos? I don't think we're going to be able to solve that. But okay, at least for this particular world cycle, will take place during the period of the... Okay, well now he's being very specific. The final break or division between the so-called black and white forces for this particular world cycle, and maybe he simply means, maybe he means simply a chain round in which various root races appear while the chain round is passing through our particular globe. But anyway, it will take place during the period of the sixth root race in the present round. Now, what does he mean there by final break or division? He doesn't necessarily mean the banishing of these enemies, but at least a clear idea of who they are and the fact that they are not to be followed. So the final break or division between the so-called black and white forces will take place during the period of the sixth root race. It's impending. It is impending. We're not far away from it at all, but it will last about 10 million years. Towards the close of the sixth root race, before the emergence of the seventh, we shall have the true Armageddon, about which so much has been taught. Now, sometimes I've thought that that Armageddon has to do with the Judgment Day, because he does describe how at the point of the Judgment Day, sort of a catastrophic interaction between the different forces does occur. But now I'm going to have to note this. Armageddon. Maybe earlier than the Judgment Day in the fifth round. So this is very, I would say, interesting and important information. Certainly, in my understanding, it's filling in some blanks, and I guess we all have them as we read. There are places where the dots are not connected and where the knowledge is not entirely synthesized, and I think I can say that this was one for me. Towards the close of the sixth root race, that's impending, a 10 million year period. Before the emergence of the seventh root race, we shall have the true Armageddon. Now we just have a kind of anticipation of Armageddon. And it's interesting that in the Bible or the books that speak of the great battle, there should be so much prophecy which denotes certain planetary events very far in the future from the time it was written. Even if we were to write it now, it would be very far into the future. I mean, think of it. The fifth root race has been operating maybe for a million years, and in some form, coincidentally with the fourth root race, for longer. And now we're talking about the end of a 10 million year root race. This is a long time ahead. Okay, a small cycle corresponding to this final battle and cleavage will appear during the sixth subrace, which is now in process of formation. So, you know, right now we're cultivating the abstract mind. This is the work of that which is to be done during the sixth subrace of the fifth root race, and there will be, a smaller, maybe probably much smaller, anticipation of the great Armageddon. So I think it's here that the information on Armageddon is at its clearest. I mean, it's so easy to go off incorrectly regarding occult technicalities and think there's nothing to examine. I see it happening all the time, so we have to be very careful regarding this timing. The World War, which is just taking place, and that would be, considering when this was written, the First World War, and our present cycle of separativeness and upheaval do not constitute the real Armageddon. And yet I was told by some people in Agni Yoga, well, we've just passed through Armageddon. But maybe not. The war, which is told to us in the Mahabharata, and the present war had the roots of their trouble and the seeds of the disasters which they brought about, one in the lower and one in the higher astral world. The war which is told to us in the Mahabharata, how do we pronounce that? Mahabharata. And the present war had their roots of their trouble and the seeds of the disasters which they brought about, one in the lower and one in the higher astral world. I suppose the earlier one was the lower, I suppose. Earlier war had the seeds in the lower astral world. Selfishness and desire of a low order were the impulses back of them both. And yet we're talking about the higher astral world, maybe certain longings for glamorous unrealities were characteristic of the recent war. Selfishness and desire of a low order were the impulses back of them both. The coming great division will have its roots in the mental world and will consummate in the six sub-race. Well, we're certainly not done with wars, are we? And this whole idea of peace, you know, let us have peace. Well, there will be an era of peace, we're told in the Bible and, you know, various books surrounding the Christian prophetic presentation. But other conflicts are planned in order to have a decisive victory of one force or another. So there, before the great Armageddon in the, what should we say, towards the close of the sixth root race, we don't know how long that will last. The root races may be increasing in length now, maybe. And the fifth root race seems to have taken a shorter time than the fourth, but maybe again there will be an increase. I mean, when we talk about 10 million years and the sixth root race, somewhere in the teaching here, it discusses that. That's a long time, much longer than we've had the occasion to experience the Aryan or fifth root race. So the coming great division will have its roots in the mental world and will consummate in the sixth root race. Now, if higher mind is to be cultivated in this sixth subrace of the fifth, maybe it'll be a war, you know, perhaps a conflict between higher and lower mind, maybe. In the sixth root race, it will have the seeds of potential portentous disaster in the coordinated triplicity of mind, astralism, and physical nature, which will bring about a climaxing moment for the planetary duality. Do we mean the relationship between soul and personality? It's not that we're going to have peace forever. It is planned that these decisive warring moments, in a planetary sense, will emerge. And that gives one pause, doesn't it? Because sometimes we say, well, let there be peace and let the peace be continuous. But when different principles of the planetary logos contend with each other and have representatives among humanity, which stand for one or the other, there will be a confrontation. Well, beyond that, we need not go. For humanity, the humanity of the sixth round will be so different in nature to ours that those who will differentiate into the black and the white forces, and those who will differentiate into the black and white force that will be so unlike what we now understand in the words that we need not concern ourselves with that far distant problem. I guess in the universe, problems will continuously arise. It will not be smooth sailing all the way through. I'll just put that down, you know, in the universal process, problems continuously arise. Okay. You know, it kind of makes you look out into the vastness and see the galaxies and how they interact with each other and how they apparently collide. Those must be huge events and huge antagonisms in those collisions must emerge, but all for the working out of the universal plan, whatever that is. We hardly know what the divine plan for our planet is, and so when we think about the entire universal process, we're not going to get very far in terms of accuracy. But anyway, the Armageddon is occurring apparently at the end of the sixth round, right? So a break or division occurs in the sixth root race in the present round, but there's another round here, which will see the banishing of this group of workers. And here it is. They will meet their end, at least with respect to our planet. Who knows what is their solar systemic fate? They are part of the plan of the solar logos, or at least he's able to factor them in as part of the plan. For our planetary logos, I think they constitute really an interference and cannot be so easily manipulated. Their end and the cessation of their activities will come about in that far distant eon or cycle. Let's call it a cycle, which is technically called the sixth round. And if we're remaining within our chain, well, then it's not as far away as if we're thinking about a sixth scheme round, which involves passage and activation, passage to and activation of various chains rather than globes, as in a chain round. So the final break, and a break is not the banishing of them, them meeting their end, it's a break, and it's in consciousness, will occur for this particular world cycle. And a world cycle here looks like it means probably whoopsie. Okay. Probably a Manvantara or chain round. So that's probably the world cycle we're talking about, and we're in the fourth. We are in the fourth chain round with respect to our with respect to our globe, with respect to our particular chain, rather. Okay, sorry that I got lost here. We're in the chain round with respect to, I should have said, our chain within our scheme. The focus is on the fourth chain, and within the fourth chain, a kind of fourth round is occurring, and by the time we reach the sixth root race, of our the six root rays of our particular Manvantara or round, there will be a break. So we see several things. And let's just see if we can identify these, because otherwise we will get into trouble. All right, so there is an occurrence at the end of the sixth round. There is also an occurrence at the end of the at the close of the sixth root race. There is also an occurrence during the sixth subrace of the fifth root race. And here, you know, he kind of tells us what they are, their banishment at the end of the sixth round, the final break for this world cycle during the sixth root race, and during the sixth sub-race of the fifth root race, there will be a big battle. Well, I hope you can make all that out. He is giving us a sequence, and I did kind of present it in reverse order here. So the world war is not the Armageddon, really. And that world war had its problem, the seeds, long ago in the great battle in the Mahabharata. And it's a continuation. Now we're even told that the leaders of the two types of forces are the same as they were in those days. But the coming great division, which will occur in the sixth subrace, and probably it will last a while, that subrace, will have its roots in the mental world and will bring about the climaxing moment for the planetary duality. So in the sixth root race, a greater battle than in the sixth subrace of the fifth root race, and all the personality of the planetary logos will be involved. All right, we don't need to go further, because it's a long time coming, and we wouldn't even recognize the humanity of that period. It's so many, finally, so many millions of years ahead when we're talking about the sixth round, because between rounds there have to be these kind of interludes or pauses. And so if a round is going to last some 300 million years, then there's going to be a pause before the next round begins. We're talking about significant amounts of time. Anyway, that was a little bit intricate, and I hope I didn't add confusion to the problem. But let's just say three major periods in order: the sixth subrace of the fifth root race, the close of the sixth root race, and the close of the sixth round. And these are just decisive. And it's kind of interesting that this battle with the Black Lodge is occurring under the auspices of the number six, and it's very Martian in that respect. We have the number of the beast, the 666, and we have the idea that the astral plane perhaps does not really exist, and that it is an area of greatest illusion at this time, and so much has to be straightened out in the domain of the six so it does not overcome us. And a larger way of thinking about that is that the non-sacred planet Mars must not be allowed to overcome the more sacred planet Earth, which is on its way to becoming more like the sacred planet Venus. So let it be remembered that the true black magician, I refer not here to a person with a tendency to black magic, is a soulless entity. So does, and let's, what does that really mean? Does he have a soul or angel in attendance? Maybe that's what it means. A soulless entity. He is a being in whom the ego is, as we understand the term today, non-existent. He may, however, have a lotus. He may have a lotus on the higher mental plane. There were lotuses in earlier methods of individualization, and they did not involve the work of a solar angel in creating the lotus. Well, sometimes DK speaks of powerful black magicians working on the higher mental plane. And sometimes Master Moria has some very unpleasant images about what lotuses can look like, whether they are chakras or the egoic lotus itself. In the case of a black magician who is not receiving the higher impulses, his form of nourishment comes from other and Devic sources, which those on the path of the good have either ignored or overcome. They're certainly not under the power of the same kind of material deva, great material deva, that is the source of power for a black magician. Well, there is intricacy here, you know, and hopefully we can understand something of it. He is a being in whom the ego is, as we understand the term today, and notice that qualifier, meaning that the ego, as we do not understand the term today, may be somewhat present. It is oft overlooked and seldom grasped or told that they, therefore, do not exist in physical bodies. And this I seem to really remember in a pointed way, that the black magician has lost his ability to work on the dense physical plane. I guess it's the ego that makes that possibility into a manifested reality. And if he is without the ego, then the usual physical equipment, for whatever reason, is not generated. Anyway, let's just take this at face value. It is oft overlooked and seldom grasped or told that they, therefore, do not exist in physical bodies. Their world is ever the world of illusion. They work from the lower mental plane, which for them is as an independent sphere, a great disaster, DK tells us. He doesn't want that to happen to the average human being, that a 13th sphere would be created. They work on desire matter and on the sentient desire bodies of those on the physical plane who are swept by delusion and held in the bonds of extreme selfishness and self-centeredness. I think sometimes we have that kind of working going on even now among certain leaders who are in the bonds of extreme selfishness and self-centeredness and therefore can be attracted to the streams of energy coming forth from, or force rather, from the black magician. So right here we have, you know, the end of 1 hour, end of hour one for a treatise on white magic video commentary number, not allowed, number four. There's got to be a four somewhere, doesn't there? Okay, so number four, and we'll go on to the second hour. We'll see how long this will last. Okay. So, this is probably a piece of information that doesn't come to us from other places. There is a center, who knows where exactly, probably on the lower levels of the astral plane called Mara Kara, the place of Mara, the place of illusion, of delusion, deception, and so forth, which is the residence on the astral plane of these types of entities. But that they do not exist in physical bodies, well, maybe it's a matter of convenience or incapacity or the realization that they can get their objectives accomplished more easily without the limitations of a dense physical body, perhaps. We're still on a planet where there's a great battle going on between selfishness and unselfishness, between evil and good, between that which deviates strongly from the divine plan of our planetary logos and that which is in accord with it. And as students of esotericism, we want to be in accord with the patterns of the divine plan. What the ignorant call a black magician on the physical plane is only some man or woman sensitive to or en rapport with true black magic on the astral plane. That's interesting. I mean, you know, maybe we had bluebeards and you know, this sort of woman in Hungary who was a serial killer, really, a noble woman who had some terrible ideas about draining the youth and vitality from young girls, Elizabeth Bathory, was she Hungarian, Bulgarian, Slovenian, in that area, you know. There's a lot of those Dracula-type events which have occurred in that particular area, the Transylvania area. And the myths are perpetuated among us, and maybe, in fact, they were realities. But even these are not true black magicians. Whatever transformation they might undergo on the after death, and whether they would remain, and whether the thread of possibility for incarnation would be snapped, and whether the ego would abandon them, the soul or angel, abandon them to their own devices, that remains to be seen. So anyway, the true black magician on the astral plane, and this is a change in the views, rather ignorant and rather dramatic views of people who don't know any better, and seeing a rather evil person think of them as a black magician. This relationship is only possible, you know, between someone on the outer plane and a true black magician. So I guess what it says is that even Hitler and his group were not true black magicians, but they were taken over somehow by powerful entities from the astral plane and from the lower mental plane, and then later abandoned when hope was lost for the victory of the selfish intent. This relationship is only possible when there have been many lives of selfishness, low desire, perverted intellectual aspiration, and the love of the lower psychism, and this only when the man has been held willingly in thrall by them. The man has willed that he will participate in this type of activity. And DK did say about that group surrounding Hitler that for lives they have had given themselves to selfish pursuits. I wonder if it's true, you know, what is sometimes said about Hitler, that he was a fallen knight of the Holy Grail, and by the name of Klingsor, he appeared in the opera, Wagnerian opera, Parsifal, and that his sworn intent was to mislead, captivate, and make fall the knights of the Grail, that he would do anything he could to make them fail, as he had failed. Okay, well, we begin to understand, you know, who are the truly selfish ones among us, and somewhere DK talks about the extraordinarily successful work of the White Lodge in making sure that so few take this left-hand path and wind up perhaps as a true black magician. Such men and women are few and far between, for unadulterated selfishness is rare indeed. Where it exists, it is exceedingly potent, as are all one-pointed tendencies. Well, maybe people like ourselves don't come in direct contact with people of this nature. I'm remembering before one full moon meeting at the Lucis Trust, I met a man. He seemed to be associated with the Arcane School, but he just said, "I'm only interested in matter, only matter." And he seemed to have no opportunity, no inclination towards the more subjective, soul-oriented pursuits in esotericism. For him, esotericism was the study of the occult properties of matter. And I could not judge, you know, how far he had gone along this path of form, but I did recognize a different vibration. The clue to the requirements of a more esoteric kind is given to us in Rule 13. You know, we're on 13.1 now, right? The magician must recognize the four. Well, probably most of us don't even recognize the presence of the etheric body, yet alone differentiate the shades of violet by means of which these spheres of the etheric world present themselves. He has, the real magician, he has presumably built up a fine character. We have to make sure that's true of us. He has educated himself for service, and there are so many pitfalls there. We may think we're serving when we're only enhancing our own ego, you know. His aspiration is true and steady, not something that comes and goes, right? He is living purely and unselfishly. He has mastered somewhat the meaning of meditation. Somewhat is a good qualifier, as meditation is such a deep and extensive subject. He now has to begin to train himself in what is called occult recognition. So these are the foundations necessary before one can recognize the lower four profitably and positively. Positively. So, you know, we can measure ourselves against this kind of foundational requirement, and hopefully we measure up for when the time that the functional details are presented to us because we can utilize them and can be trusted. This rule is a most interesting example of the many connotations and numerous correspondences which can be conveyed in a few simple words. We are told he must recognize the four. So, a big background in occultism is sometimes necessary when simple but profound sentences of instruction are presented. Okay, a big background in occultism. You know, we so often occultists speak in numbers. The fifth presided over the fourth, who had the third, who had left the third, you know. And what are we talking about there? Solar angels, newly made human beings, departing from the animal kingdom. But who would know that unless one had a background in occultism and could fill in the probable meaning of those numbers? So recognize the four. And this, of course, is going to require etheric vision and probably the light in the head and whatever makes that inner recognition possible. The treatise in Cosmic Fire in this regard is telling us this means literally that the magician must be in a position to discriminate between the different ethers and to note the special hue of the different levels, thereby ensuring a balanced building of the shadow. We have to know what materials we are using, and they are of different colors. What materials are we using to build a balanced structure? Purple. Sorry. How about spelling, huh? Purple, violet, light violet, and lavender. Moving from the fourth ether upward to the first. He recognizes them in the occult sense. That is, he knows their note and key and is aware of a particular type of energy they embody. Now, probably most of us are far from that and have to be trained in that type of recognition, and that will be coming when sound and color are given the attention they deserve during some phase of the Aquarian Age. Enough emphasis has not been laid upon the fact that the three higher levels of the etheric plane are in vibratory communication with the three higher planes of the cosmic physical plane, you know, logoic, monadic, and atmic. So the first, second, and third ethers on the physical plane, systemic physical plane, are in touch with those higher ethers. Okay, vibratory communication with the three higher planes of the cosmic physical plane, and they, with their ensphering fourth level, I guess all of these planes are really spheres, and elsewhere he tells us how the planes and the rays rotate as spheres within and in relation to each other. So planes are spherical. And there's a kind of embodiment that occurs in relation to the fourth level. And they, with their ensphering fourth level, have been called in the occult books the inverted tetractys. So let's just say the four cosmic ethers. It is this knowledge, which puts the magician in possession of the three types of planetary force and their combination, or the fourth type. See, it's kind of like the personality, only in inversion. We have our physical etheric, our astral, mental, and they combine to make the personality. And here we're moving from above to below, and whatever is found logoically, monadically, atmically is embodied in an etheric sense on the Buddhic plane, the fourth ether of a cosmic kind. It is this knowledge which puts the magician in possession of the three types of planetary force and their combination, or the fourth type, and thus releases for him that vital energy which will drive this idea into objectivity. So without the fourth ether, we're not having objectivity. I suppose the fourth ether then, in a cosmic sense, becomes very important for whatever we find on the lower 21 or even 18 subplanes constituting the dense physical body of the planetary logos, and also when we're talking about 21 subplanes of the solar logos, and if we extend it to all the planets, you know, the 21 subplanes on all planets relate to the dense physical body of the solar logos. So objectivity in that sense is driven by the activities of the Buddhic plane, just the way the fourth ether is combining the powers of the first, second, and third ether, and creates the objectivity of the to be found on the densest systemic levels, what we normally call the dense physical appearance of gaseous, liquid, and dense material that strangely we regard as the major reality. Some people even finding that all of consciousness and whatever internal faculties we have arise out of matter as an epiphenomenon of matter. And I guess Blavatsky has put the lie to that one. It's really the other way around, isn't it? But it is hard for modern man, with his very materialistic proclivities, to see that which is dense coming out of that which is subtle. For him, somehow, it's easier to see that which is subtle arising out of that which is dense. And that is a reversal. As these, as the different types of forces meet and coalesce, a dim, shadowy form clothes itself upon the vibrating astral and mental sheath, and the idea of the solar angel is attaining definite concretion. So this is a higher type of working. This type of precipitation involves the spiritual triad, the soul on the higher mental plane, and the clothing of lower mental and astral matter. Well, I think we have a lot to learn even about how from the fourth ether the arrangement of matter occurs in the creation of the dense physical body, but this is a higher type of magic and involves the cosmic ethers first, and then the precipitation of whatever is created on those levels by a high magician, and thence descending into much denser objectivity eventually. So how do we see these things? How do we differentiate? How do we hear the sounds? How do we see the colors? How do we know the quality? Always we are moving from that which is subtle. We are densifying the subtle. We'll just put that down. In this magical process, we are densifying that which is subtle. And I, you know, there are planets that are in conditions of subtlety, and they are coming into incarnation and seeking densification. So much is going on in our solar system that we who simply observe what is already there, we don't understand. We don't understand the process of coming and going into incarnation, out of incarnation, but I think it will be revealed, and then we will see the analogy, won't we? We will see the analogy of the magical process and the birth process within the microcosm man. We'll see the connection between what is happening astronomically and what is happening microcosmically within the individual. Okay, so the most obvious and most apparent, the obvious and most apparent meaning is, therefore, recognition of the four ethers. But of course, the four cosmic ethers maybe also have to be recognized. But this is, in its turn, dependent upon other meanings and based upon the recognition of other quaternaries. Okay. I guess we can see, you know, how, what a demanding study all of this is. And if we're not, we say it's only book knowledge, you know, so why are you studying it? Work it all out from within yourself. Yes, I would say so, but also take advantage of the great download of knowledge, which is possible by those benevolent higher sources who have now seen fit to make it available to ourselves. Best to take advantage of it when it is presented. I would like to give a short resume of some of the qualifications needed by the White Magician and of some of the recognitions which will gradually emerge in his consciousness. So here, this is probably pretty practical. We are moving into the physical level, and we're going to understand more of what is required in a practical sense. So the White Magician, that's what we want to become, you know, just the way every member of hierarchy is, to some extent, a white magician. So every member of hierarchy is, to some extent, an esoteric psychologist. These disciplines may or may not be their major discipline, but they acquire them as they move into this higher point of tension we call the heart center of the planet, the hierarchy. So, you know, whether we are equipped with the seventh or the third ray, or I don't know what other rays will be involved, I suppose, which make of us a white magician, or at least make that our specialty, we will, to some extent, as we come closer to the ashram, integrate in the ashram, integrate in hierarchy, we will, to some extent, be white magicians. So these are recognitions. So what do we have here? Qualifications. And I think, you know, let's just make it reddish so that we can really see it. Qualifications and recognitions. First, you must recognize the four that constitute the one. In other words, the first quaternary that he must know and know well is that which he is essentially himself. So what we're talking about here is the necessary recognition of various quaternaries. Before the four referenced in this rule can be recognized. He's told us, you know, other quaternaries are involved. So he must recognize first the four, which constitute the one. In other words, the first quaternary must be that which he is. Physical body, sensitive emotional nature, mind and soul. Is that one quaternary? Soul, mind, brain, and the outer world of forces. Well, there are four things mentioned. spirit, soul, body within the greater whole. Well, each one of those points is a kind of quaternary, but maybe each of the numbered three is meant to be one factor within a still larger quaternary. This presupposes real spiritual attainment and the capacity, therefore, to function as a soul, and I suppose no one should be a white magician. No one can be a true white magician unless functioning as a soul, which means the third initiation. Okay. Until that has been achieved, one can be an aspirant to the practice of white magic, but not yet a white magician, and that is what we should call ourselves if we're really profoundly interested in this subject. We cannot go around calling ourselves white magicians, but rather aspirants to the practice of white magic, and one day when we have taken the third initiation and can truly be trusted and have battled it out with the negative forces in the desert, alone and apparently unaided, then maybe we can take the Syrian path of initiation and take the third degree and be transfigured and live as a soul and can be more than simply an aspirant to the practice of white magic. Okay, so the four that constitute the one, well, maybe each one of these is, in a sense, the same thing, except one of them has spirit, and different elements are mentioned in these quaternaries. We seem to have three quaternaries here. Each is fourfold, and we have to recognize the spirit within us, the soul that we are, and the body, and also the greater whole. Everyone has four factors. Here we have been given 12 factors, and some are repeated. Okay. Right. Second, these are requirements, right? There are so many requirements, I hope. Qualifications for the white magician and various recognitions. Two, he must recognize the city that stands four square. He must understand the meaning of the man, the cube, and this in three ways. So here is a sort of a geometrical recognition. Sorry. Well, what do we have? We have himself as the human being. So he is standing four square, and also a cube, if we take in some of the higher principles. He recognizes his fellow man in relation to himself and the whole, maybe the collection of beings we call humanity is like a greater city that stands four square. He recognizes the, other individuals, let's say. He recognizes himself and the equivalents to other individuals, and then the fourth kingdom of nature, the human kingdom, viewing that entire kingdom as an entity and organized life functioning on the physical plane, indwelt by soul and animated by spirit. So himself, others, and humanity as a whole. recognition of himself, of others, and humanity as a whole. This means, therefore, that as a man, he is responsive to his kind and is aware also of the purpose of the kingdom to which he belongs. You know, he is sensitive and not isolated or isolatively selfish. Is there such a word as isolatively? Well, there will be now. This can best be expressed in some wonderful words from the ancient writing of the Master's archives. It is said to date back to early Atlantean times, and this could be 12 million years ago. He does talk about early Atlantean times as 12 million years ago. We're going to have problems there. It's always telling me that the disk is too full. You want to try saving again? And yes, I do. And I'm hoping it's, you know, maybe just too big a file. Okay. The material, I mean, obviously DK is admitted to the library. And one day it might be a fine thing to see all that is written in the annals of planetary history as needed, you know, if we need to see these things. Let me just do that. Okay. The material on which the writing is found is so old and so frail that all that the masters themselves can touch and see is a precipitation made from it. The original being kept at Shambhala. You kind of wonder how, of what is the nature of the matter of Shambhala, that an original made of normal matter can be kept there. So questions arise as to how this can be done. As to how matter, a book made of matter, can be stored in an etheric or cosmic etheric state we call Shambhala. So anyway, he's three kinds of responsiveness: himself, others, and humanity. And certain deletions have been put in here. And DK thinks it's wiser not to insert them. At the four corners of the square, the four angelic, and, you know, there's an ellipsis there. What are they? Four angelic something are seen. Orange they are. Connecting with the fifth ray thus, but veiled in rosy light. The veil has to do with astralism, and that color rose, which has to do with the astral body in the sixth ray. Within each form, the yellow flame is seen, and round each form, the blue. Maybe the yellow is associated with Buddhi, and the blue with some deeper spiritual center yet. He calls this wonderful words, and I guess from us, for us, they would be difficult to interpret. Four words they utter forth, these angelic presences, whatever they are, one for each human race, but not the sacred sound which bringeth forth the seventh. So 3, 4, 5, 6 is what we're dealing with. Races, 3, 4, 5, 6, probably, because these are the individualized races, and the seventh is not yet evoked. Two words have died away, the unconscious races, right? Four sound today. Two words have died away, the words of the first and second we'll call them human races. They're not really human. They're not individualized in that sense. They're, are they animal races? The, what is it, the Adamic race and the Hyperborean race. Four sound today, or at least the sixth is coming in, the third is dying out, and four and five are sounding. One sounds in realms so high that man can enter not as man. Well, is this, is, let me see if I can get rid of that. So is this Chohanship? Is this Chohanship? Because it is said of the Chohans, you know, they are no longer men as are the masters, and they are associated with the sixth initiation. Thus are the seven words of man ringing around the square. Well, maybe also the Chohans are of the sixth and seventh initiations. Thus are the seven words of man ringing around the square, passing from mouth to mouth, from the one who utters to the next one who takes it up and utters it with qualifications. Each day of man, the words take form and different scene. What is a day? It is symbolic measure. A symbolic measure. And we have to ask, are there 7 days? Certainly 7 rays. Okay. Each day of man, you know, the world was created, what, in 7 days? So the allegory goes, but of course, these are lengthy periods of evolutionary process and not the kind of minuscule day we have from the rotation of the earth once around. So each day of man, the words take form and different seem. In blank, the words will be as follows. Now, what will that be? Will that be like the fourth chain? I'm not sure. There have been ellipses here. There have been omissions, and DK doesn't want us receiving too much information here. Out of the north, a word is chanted, which means blank, be pure. Even in the various lodges, the north is a direction of high and transhuman spirituality. From out the south, you know, think about your system. North is above, south is below. From out the south, the word peals out, I dedicate, and what else do I do? I dedicate and manifest, because the south is the place of manifestation. From out the east, bringing a light divine. Well, that fits well, because the east is always considered to be the source of light. A word comes swinging round the square, love all. And that's beautiful. And we have, you know, at least our great sun or source of light rising in the east. Our Sova Bhavosu is a sun of love. And maybe this is going to apply to our particular configuration, our Sova Bhavosu. And from out the west, the answer is thrown back. The west is the area of form I serve. And we have seen how form, service to the form brings liberation from the prison which the form imposes. And some of these verbs are kind of interesting. Swinging round the square. How can we know what that means? But it does suggest something, a type of motion. And thrown back, there's a response, isn't it? And when you play catch with somebody, you know, something is thrown to them and they throw back. So there's an interplay here, perhaps between East and West. He says they are wonderful words. Well, for us, they are, you know, obscure words, but a little bit we can fathom. A little bit. This is a faint effort to express in English these ancient Atlantean phrases older than Sanskrit or Sensar. And I guess what we have to say, maybe it is so, maybe Sensar is Aryan, belonging to the fifth root race. And certainly I think Sanskrit is Aryan, belonging to the fifth root race. This is a faint effort to express in English these ancient Atlantean phrases older than Sanskrit. It's called the language of the gods, but we have plenty of time to evolve a language during the fifth root race. And it pertains to the first subrace of the fifth root race, so it pertains to the Indian or Hindu group, the Brahmanical group, you know, the first of the five, and thus perhaps emerged from the Atlantean group and solidly within the Aryan, and is known only to a handful of the members of the present hierarchy. DK has obviously done some digging in the library there. He is the great scholar, of course, but a practical scholar. But in the thoughts of purity, dedication, love, and service are summed up the nature and destiny of man, and it should be remembered that they do not stand for so-called spiritual qualities, but for potent occult forces, dynamic in their incentive and creative in their results. So these are the words, and they are mentioned in this ancient document, ancient purity, dedication, love, and service, and it's worth expanding them as the major messages that we get here from the north, purity from the south, dedication, and something else. From the east, love, and from the west, service. This should be pondered on carefully by all aspirants. We have consequently with these four added to the first one, spiritual attainment, five of the qualifications of the white magician. So, okay, let's look at them. Spiritual attainment. Purity, this number from the south, what is it? Dedication. Okay, well, it's a solar plexus in the south, I suppose. Dedication. And then something additional to dedication, which is love. And from the west, service. So we have been looking at the qualifications of the true white magician. And here we have them listed. Okay, so that was a rather long section, and we have here various recognition of quaternaries and What do we have here? Some of the qualifications and recognitions for the white magician, the kind of recognitions as he is to recognize the four, but there's more than one four, isn't there? So we have here number, where is this? The four that constitute the one. So this is the recognition of various quaternaries, and I'll make it quite big so that we do not miss it. First, recognizing the four that constitute the one. Second, the city that stands for square, the various modes of man. You know, man himself, man the other, man as humanity, and then now, after a little while of study, we have come to the third type of recognition. Right. Okay. The white magician. Well, I mean, you know, we have to know how we will equip ourselves to really fulfill these things. It's so common to have someone walk into an area of possible activity, a possible labor, unequipped. You know, if you haven't driven a car, you don't go to your driving test. And if you haven't practiced the piano, you don't give a concert. So there are so many areas where real preparation, the attainment of quality is necessary. And how often can we truly assess the degree of our qualification to perform various feats? Third, the white magician must recognize the cross which stands in the heavens, upon which the cosmic Christ is crucified, and on which the white magician, being a cell in the body of the cosmic Christ, is also crucified. Which cross is this? I suppose we might say that there is a liberation of the cosmic Christ upon the cardinal cross, but that there is crucifixion upon the fixed cross of the soul, and the issue of conscious crucifixion is not taken up in that preparatory cross that we call the mutable cross. The white magician must recognize the cross which stands in the heavens, upon which the cosmic Christ, is it of a solar system? Is it beyond that? Is crucified, and on which the white magician, being a cell in the body of the cosmic Christ. Now that is an interesting identification, way of identifying a white magician. But obviously the white magician is functioning under the soul, and he is a soul, and he is a cell in the body of a greater soul, we call the cosmic Christ, is also crucified. I suppose you can be a white magician before you become a master, and by the time you're a master, you are being liberated from the fixed cross. At the fourth degree, there is a transition, and at the third degree, you are definitely capably crucified upon the fixed cross. You're crucified, but you can function. And the first and second degrees have you mounting the fixed cross, but your capability is not very extensive yet, because these are preparatory initiations, probationary initiations. Technically and astrologically speaking, in this present eon, which I guess he can call a Manvantara, or around, he must understand the inner significance of Taurus, of Leo, of Scorpio, and of Aquarius, for they are potent in our world cycle. Our world cycle now we have a solar system as a world cycle. Why is that? Because the fixed cross is the cross of the soul, and in this solar system we are building or functioning eventually as souls. Now maybe the next solar system, the cross will be the cardinal cross, and we will function as spirit. But now I think we can see our world cycle can mean the duration of a solar system. Yes, it can mean that. Sometimes these words are so general that it's hard to know how to apply them. So blinding light, fiery pain, bitter woe, and liberation. These are the four terms that apply to the fixed cross, the Christ or solar logoic consciousness being particularly related to these four signs, because it is cosmic soul that is being developed. Well, solar systemic soul, I mean, our solar logos is an initiative of the second degree, so therefore on the path of probationary cosmic initiation and not yet a fully transfigured expressing soul the way Sirius is. But it does look as if the third and fourth initiations minimally will be taken in this fifth or second major incarnation of our solar logos. So the fixed cross is very important. So to be a true white magician, we have to be crucified on the fixed cross and have to have some experience with the fixed cross, not just as a probationary initiate of the first or second degree, but we have to have reached the third degree. We're still crucified, but we are capable upon the fixed cross, capable of identifying as a soul. He must, if I may express it symbolically and yet at the same time accurately, be able to utter forth the achievement, which is the goal of his endeavor in each of these four signs and under each of these four powers. So he has the achievement of each of these four signs. This is, let's just say, he possesses achievement upon the fixed cross. You know, it's not a beginner who is a white magician, an aspirant. It's not a white magician, even a probationary initiate. Is simply an aspirant to the practice of magic, as we have been told before. In Taurus, he must be able to say, I seek illumination and am myself the light. I am the light of the world. In Leo, he will say, I know myself to be the one. I rule by law, not the capricious law of one's own personal self, but the law of the one in whom we live and move and have our being, and that would be planetary or even solar. The word he will utter forth in Scorpio is, illusion cannot hold me. I am the bird that flies with utter freedom. So he is the eagle. And so often we elevate the symbol of the scorpion into that of the eagle when we think of the higher possibilities of Scorpio. In Aquarius, the word spoken will be, I am the server and I am the dispenser of the living water. Well, this is such, these particular statements are not found as commonly as the mantram, as you know, associated with the zodiacal signs, and yet they are very, very important when it comes to listing the attainments of a true white magician. Can we say this? Excuse me. Can we say, I seek illumination and am myself the light? You know, just pause with it. Can we say it and mean it? And can it be true of us? Each full moon, of course, we have a concerted attempt to approach close enough to the energy to be able more and more to identify with those energies and be able to say these things because we have realized them to be the truth. I know myself to be the one. Well, I rule by law. And the law is the law of the one in whom we live and move and have our being. So minimally, the planetary logos and maybe the solar logos functioning through cosmic laws of synthesis, attraction, repulsion, and economy. And, you know, the negative part of Scorpio, let Maya flourish and deception rule. But we're out from under that, and the Hydra has been defeated. And we have identification with higher energies upon the Buddhic intuitive plane, which causes the illusion to die. Illusion cannot hold me. I am the bird that flies with utter freedom. You kind of think about the law of sacrifice in relation to Scorpio. And there is that rosy cross and the bird above. Because we have liberated ourselves from the cross through sacrifice. And in Aquarius, well, it's liberation, but liberation through service. And the more I dispense the living waters, the more liberated I am. So let's try to remember this. I mean, I'm saying to myself, well, gee, you know, it's been a number of years here, and I have not had these things in mind, and they are very good. But what you have to be able to say as a true white magician, I'm going to recommend this to those around me. These occult qualifications upon which I have lightly touched must be closely studied by the aspirant as he studies them, and as he studies them and lives by these rules, various qualifications will emerge and will distinguish him. Obviously, not only meditation, but study is required for the emergence of the qualifications. Let us hold the balance and not underestimate any one of the three: meditation, study, and service. Okay, well, we are getting close to the 2-hour mark here in this particular program. So he's touched lightly, but we can deepen our knowledge of these statements. And they're so important. As he studies them and lives by these rules, various qualifications will emerge. It's the living by the rules, as they have been learned and studied and meditated upon, which produce the emergence of the qualities which distinguish the white magician. It must be remembered that all I have here said has a different meaning on each plane and in relation to the 7 stages of consciousness as these express themselves in the 7 fields of awareness. So, you know, each plane is really a state of consciousness. The term plane and, well, let's just say, and degree of consciousness, plane, and state of consciousness are equivalent. Somewhere he tells us this. Now, I think we can say that we have arrived at hour number 2. Glad this is not Gmail. Okay, hour number two has elapsed, and we will shortly go on to our go to hour three. All right. Right. Okay, friends, we'll do that. We'll pause here for just a moment and hopefully move on. Maybe this is not going to be so long a rule, but I don't think I can finish it in this particular program. So we will pause and then move forward. We're learning how to be a white magician. We're learning the qualifications. We're learning the recognitions. We're learning about a sure and reliable foundation for this aspect of the esoteric work, which every member of the hierarchy must have some degree of proficiency in. We're learning that. And although it may be some decades and even centuries before the actual formulas are placed in our hands, before we can be trusted to be a true co-creator with hierarchy and so forth, we are getting a good academic basis for the practical work which will come later. Yeah, the practical work. Always the masters take their time. In the long run, they build carefully, and they don't allow themselves, even in states of emergency, to generate into anything frantic or just busy, threatening a loss of control over the process. If anything, the white magician is careful. Okay, so I'll be coming on to hour three. Whoa. Can't complete it. Can't complete it. You know how it goes. All right. So, beginning of hour three, when I can get to it, and I presume it will be pretty soon. Okay, friends. So, let's move on now. And this will be probably a three-hour program. We've done 2 hours with it. Occasionally I've done a four or a five. I wonder if I've ever done a six. Well, there comes to be a limit as to how much you can transmit, how many gigabytes and so forth. Anyway, we've been looking at the occult qualifications of the white magician and the fixed cross upon which the cosmic Christ, I guess, in a solar systemic sense, is crucified. Although maybe, I don't know, maybe we can take it even beyond the solar system. And I love these words. The true white magician has to be able to say, I seek illumination and am myself the light. In Leo, that was in Taurus, he said that. In Leo, he will say, I know myself to be the one. I rule by law, and not by caprice, of course. Okay. The word he will utter forth in Scorpio will be. Notice how a whole idea or a sentence is considered to be a word. Illusion cannot hold me. I am the bird that flies with utter freedom. And we remember the first law of sacrifice and its connection, I think. Well, many of those laws of the soul are connected with Scorpio, I would say. The law of repulse is connected with Scorpio. And and the law of sacrifice, I would say, as well. In Aquarius, the words spoken will be, I am the server, and I, the dispenser, am of living water. Notice the inverted word order that comes from the archaic translation of these symbols. So going on, he says, finally, as far as the aspirant who reads these instructions is concerned, he must have transcended the Four Noble Truths. Whoa. These are, let's say, stiff. Let's see, go back here. Let's call this exacting requirements. Finally, as far as the aspirant who reads these instructions is concerned, he must have transcended the Four Noble Truths. But remember, the last of the Noble Truths is to follow the Eightfold Path. And so that's quite a requirement. Learn the meaning of the four Gospels. Presumably each one of them has a distinctive flavor or meaning or message or quality to impart. Understood the significance and purpose of the four elements, earth, water, fire, and air, ascending in that order from the physical plane to the Buddhic, and esoterically speaking, passed as a savior through the four kingdoms. So it's a high requirement. This latter phase will only be really understood at the fourth initiation. High requirements. And notice that the one who reads here is still called an aspirant. I guess no matter how high we are, we're still aspirants, unless is even the universal logos an aspirant with respect to absolute infinitude? These kind of questions dawn upon me, but they turn out to be speculative and not really answerable. Transcended the Four Noble Truths to understand that existence in the world is inescapable from suffering, and the cause of suffering is the desire to adhere to the phenomenal world, and release from suffering occurs through releasing that desire to for life in the phenomenal worlds, and the method of release is the Noble Eightfold Path, each one of which I'm sure has had many treatises written upon it. So exacting requirements, taking us all the way up to the fourth initiation, and one ascends through the kingdoms as a savior at the fourth initiation. I mean, we have saved the matter in associating with our vehicles. It is now atomic matter on all levels, and we've relinquished the egoic vehicle, and we've made our way into the fourth plane, which is the plane of intuition or air. I wonder if we can detail all that is required of us, or even remember it, you know. But anyway, he's passed through as a savior through the four kingdoms, and this is realized at the fourth degree. And when he has done this, this is telling, you know, that the true white magician is really a master. I mean, we can begin to practice a little bit of white magic, maybe when we are the transfigured initiate, and we can aspire to learn when we are probationary initiates. But truly as a master, we can say that we've entered the phase when white magical process is not foreign to us and can be wielded by us in line with the plan and purpose. When he has done all this, right, He can say, quote, desire holds me not, and freedom, with freedom now I stand. Desire holds me not, with freedom now I stand. I desire all and nothing. I live and die, am offered up, and rise again. Sacrifice. I come and go at will. The spirit is like the wind which bloweth where it listeth. Earth lies beneath my feet, and water laves my form. The fire destroys that which impedes my way, and master of the air am I. Well, it seems that he has penetrated into the Buddhic level of intuition. Through all the worlds of form, my feet have passed. The fourth degree initiate can say this. All now exists for me, and I, the servant of the whole, persist, persist. All that exists is utilized as the servant of the whole. So these are the true final requirements of the white magician. Well, we are really being acquainted with the demands, and we are not likely to rush in where angels fear to tread, or nor presume that because we have an interest in the subject, we have any real qualification in wielding white magic. Free from desire, Uranus has done its work, the wholeness is revealed, and in a way one desires to know one is all, but one doesn't want anything specific within that allness, only the wholeness of it all. One passes through the reincarnational cycle, one comes and goes, one is made a sacrifice, but one is always resurrected, and one is not held in prison, at least. The prison wouldn't seem a prison to us, who are held in much more confining prisons. I come and go between the dense physical body of the solar logos and his cosmic etheric body. I won't say any higher because we don't know the degree of initiation here. I come and go at will. I enter the body. I extract myself from the body. I have mastered the world of the senses, the earth, and the waters of space I'm familiar with, and I guess they wash my form. I go through the tests of water and fire, and the fire, the water cleanses and the fire destroys impediment. And I've penetrated at the fourth degree into the realm of intuition, so I have pure reason, and I know how things really are and what right relationship is and what is an archetype and how to make that archetype appear in the worlds below. I've passed attentively through all the four levels or the three levels of form, and as a master of the three worlds, I own, in a way, those processes, but I only own them not for myself, but because my attitude is as the servant of the whole, and I persist in my service. So very beautiful words and setting requirements, which all of us, I'm sure, have to work hard to master. I guess we pass through an understanding of what a steep climb it is, upward all the way, uphill all the way to become a true white magician or master of the wisdom, or to become a high initiate upward all the way. And we've made a certain commitment, and we have placed our hand to the plow, and, you know, we will not remove our hand from the plow. Otherwise, we are not worthy to enter the kingdom of heaven, and that kingdom is not just the sort of blissful illusions of Devachan on the fourth level of the mental plane, but really the higher worlds, the kingdom of heaven, the, as far as we're concerned, the cosmic ethers, where the master's consciousness is preeminently focused, except when they descend through sacrifice to handle things in the dense worlds. But still, I suppose, maintaining multidimensionally their awareness on the higher levels. We have to learn multidimensional consciousness as well, to be in the presence of lesser vibrations, but to still retain the input of the higher vibrations. Study these words and note how the concept of the ideal requirements, which constitute the equipment of the white magician, has steadily grown. Okay, so higher and higher requirements. Which is natural enough, you know, there are white magicians of all types of status. And there is an apprentice white magician, and there are master white magicians. I suppose we, you know, go up to the level of the planetary logos or solar logos. These great logoi are indeed tremendously powerful white magicians on their own level, and they create the forms in which we live and move and have our being. Well, there's a number of quaternaries that we've been dealing with, and they've been listed, and the man and the other and humanity itself are all quaternaries, the four planes of the personality, of course, and the four cosmic ethers are quaternaries, and there are cosmic quaternaries. You know, is the four higher than the three? Sometimes. Is the three higher than the four? Sometimes. It depends on the context, and we have to study it. I could enlarge, he says, upon many other quaternaries, but the few just quoted suffice to show some of the recognitions towards which the aspirant strives. In this case, we're looking for the qualities of the four subplanes of the systemic etheric plane and the appropriate color and sound distinctions, you know, the highest lavender, the next light violet, the next lower violet, and then purple. The only other one which I will note is that referred to as the violet four. Okay, well then maybe the devas that constitute the energies on these levels, or the four types of energy which constitute the vital or etheric body of all forms in the natural world. So another quaternary to which this rule refers. Here again, we have a higher three and a lower one. Just the way, you know, in the personality, in the way we have a lower three and a higher one. Things are always turned both ways. So there is an embodiment of a higher three in a lower Buddhic sphere. But in this particular case, it'll be a higher three systemic ethers, in the fourth ether. Okay, so here again we have a higher three and a lower one, whichever indicates the three aspects or principles of divinity in the form which these three must manifest. Well, we have will, love, and intelligence, and they have to have a form, and all of their reflections, lower reflections, have to have a form through which to manifest. All of this is the study of principles and the vehicles by which these principles are able to contact realms of lower vibration. Spirit, soul, and body express the same idea from another angle, added to that which is produced through their interaction. The three are one in this trinity, and the one, two, and three in terms of rays and aspects are reflected in the one of spirit, the two of soul, and the three of body. And there will be always some vehicle through which expression can occur. It must, and the vehicle will often be lower, so that the descent of the higher principles can reach a point of effectiveness with respect to lower energies and forces. It must ever be remembered that from the point of view of reality, what we call the dense physical body, tangible and objective, is but an illusion. You know, it seems to be the illusion to which we pay the most attention, because it is a very obvious illusion and the most tangible. And some people, you know, well, maybe a great majority, think that what you see is what you get. And this is the man. And the annihilation of this aggregation means the annihilation of man. It's a very popular and simplistic point of view, and is even found among the intelligent people who refuse to be misled by the fantasies and fancies of a religion based on fear of non-survival. I encounter it frequently, to the point that the truer theosophical esoteric point of view makes no sense to them, because all subtlety is seen to emerge from tangibility, and tangibility is impermanent, as we know. All men are mortal, and things fall apart, and with them, presumably anything we call consciousness falls apart too, and is no more. But we don't accept that, and we have some experiences which confirm for us that our non-acceptance of the vulnerability of consciousness due to the vulnerability of the tangible form is that's an illusion. It's, things are not that way. We are told again and again in the ancient writings that this physical body is not a principle. It's a dense aggregation. It's, how does he call it? Congestion. It is a congestion. The physical body is a congestion of dense materials, and is not the focus or the true focus of the entity in this solar system in which let's have an in which there, shall we? I and W? Oh. Well, in which the goal is the development of consciousness. It's the second major solar system, and the fifth in a series. including lower solar systems, and the development of soul consciousness is the goal. So this thing that we consider to be most real and with which we most identify, and the unhappy states of consciousness which result when this physical form is damaged or is fading, all of these states of consciousness are based on a prevalent illusion. So we are told again and again in the ancient writings that this physical body is not a principle. Why is this so? Because it is only an appearance brought about by the merging of the higher three and the fourth. That's the real origin of the physical body. And this appearance is a fiction or a figment of the human mind. And here we give our life and our attention to sustaining the fiction. So often we give our life to the sustainment of the fiction rather than cultivate the more real interior states. I remember DK mentioning, you know, emotional loveliness is something to cultivate, whereas people are so often concerned about doing the right thing physically, whatever they may eat and how they rest or don't, and how they take care of the body or don't. We're really putting secondary things first, or things which maybe were outlived in an earlier time, from an earlier time, and should have been outlived by now, putting those things first. So we have to get our esoteric priorities straight. He says, I speak not in parable. I utter only facts in nature and one that is slowly coming into what? Into mature consideration among the philosophers of both hemispheres. Let's say those striving for wisdom. A figment of the human mind. It is a formation given the perceptual limitations of our perceptual apparatus. And we are very still materialistic, and so we look at that which is dense as most real. I'm thinking about the weight, W-E-I-G-H-T, the weight implications of the monetary unit in England called the pound. Well, that's a Taurus personality, and with Taurus, at first, materiality and tangibility come first, and so that which is of value is considered as that which has weight, the pound. The English pound. So the heavier it is, in a way, the more real it is, which is, of course, the opposite of the esoteric truth. But we have to go through these stages on our way to valuing the reality of ethereality. 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 Think of it. Ethereality. Ethereality. Okay. I'm getting this problem here telling me I cannot save, you know. There's less than 100 pages left here, and I'm hoping it doesn't implode upon me or explode. Okay, both in the solar system, the macrocosm of the microcosm, that's one way of defining, let's just say, one way of defining the solar system, and likewise in the microcosm, that is, the unit man, that's how the term is normally considered, but it's a relative term, and we can consider any great wholeness a macrocosm and something that dwells within it, lives and moves and has its being within it as a kind of a microcosm. So likewise in the human microcosm, there are ever the three highest planes, which embody the principles and produce the dynamic purpose, and which constitute the four levels of the etheric body of both God and man, the macrocosm and the microcosm, viewing them from what we call the energy or physical angle. Interesting to think that the realm of intuition and pure reason would produce a kind of vehicle for the three higher principles. But we have to take that into consideration. These four are reflected in the four levels of the etheric division of the physical plane, the systemic ethers, those spheres which are much closer to us and really part of our physical apparatus in the subtle aspect of that apparatus. These four are reflected in the four levels of the etheric division of the physical plane as regards the physical body of all forms. I suppose there's different developments in these ethers depending upon the form involved. These four etheric levels, or these four grades of vital substance, each atomically different, I would say, simpler and simpler as we ascend, constitute what is called the true form of all material objects or phenomena, and they are responsive to the four higher types of spiritual energy, which we call divine, namely here, the cosmic ethers. Namely, there we go. So, divinity, well, where does it begin? Does it begin with the cosmic ethers, or sometimes it is said that only the higher two of the cosmic ethers should truly have the descriptor divine attached to it? Anyway, we're looking here at macrocosm and microcosm, and we're looking at parallel functions in the lives of greater and lesser beings. He does that often, of course, in Cosmic Fire a great deal, and here also in this book quite a bit. This relation between the prototypical trinity, or prototypal trinity, and its plane of merging, namely Buddhic plane. Well, anyway, here's the idea. I just want to emphasize the true form. It's quite possible that the planets in our solar system at some point will dematerialize their outer crust, but they still will have a physical form, and it will be their true form, and it will be the etheric form of the dense planet. There are all kinds of subtle spheres, but only one globe per chain. Maybe the Earth chain is a little different because of the failure of the moon chain. I don't think we're going to find density. It's interesting that we have density on the within the moon chain and the moon globe, and also in the Earth chain and globe. But there has to be some reason for that, having to do with the lunar failure, or the failure of the planetary logos to manifest as intended on the moon chain. So, all forms have this fourfoldness. The relation between the prototypal trinity and its plane of merging. Let's just put that down, what that plane of merging is, so we remember it. And the etheric reflection is found in all forms according to the type of energy which predominates. Imagine the ethers are in a way much more active and reflective of higher states in man than in the animal, or in the plant, or even in the mineral. In each of the four kingdoms in nature, all four types are to be found, but the fourth etheric is found in fuller degree in the mineral kingdom than in the human, whilst the highest of the four ethers is found in greater proportion, in the human than in the other three kingdoms. So there are differences, in the degree of activity or intensity of these different ethers in relation to the different kingdoms. So note the kingdom and then the ether, which is most active or full, as he seems to be saying. This which I tell you is apt to be found confusing by the neophyte for the words energy, dynamic purpose, vitality, and etheric substance mean but little to the beginner. Well, we have to begin somewhere, don't we? But they serve to indicate some of the knowledge which the worker in white magic has to grasp. By no means just an aspirant, an experienced person in the field of occultism, relatively experienced. Certainly, that is what we would call a true magician, a transfigured initiate of the third degree. No beginner, as normally considered. This I might illustrate, for instance, by stating that working in the mineral kingdom, the fourth kingdom in nature, from the standpoint of God, and the first from the standpoint of time and space, he will work with the fourth cosmic ether, Buddhic energy, utilizing ether of the fourth grade in his own body as the transmitting agent, and so on in connection with the other three kingdoms of nature. So we could expand on that idea. And that we would find that if we're working with the plant kingdom, perhaps it's the atmic level. Is that possible? Its color is green. Is that possible? And then he would work with the third ether in approaching changes, etheric changes, in the vegetable kingdom, and then for the animal, it would be the monadic level. Interesting, if true. And he would work with the second ether in his own apparatus. And for man, the logoic level would be implicated. He would work with the first ether. Well, anyway, the correspondences are possibly there, but to confirm them, DK says, and so forth, and so on, you know. So we're invited to make that comparison. The man is somehow connected with the logoic cosmic ether. And then maybe when working with other men, working within the fourth kingdom of nature, that particular ether, systemically considered, has to be activated and full, and it's as if to say that an initiate of the fourth degree who has a very strong atomic subplane activation in the ethers is equipped, really, to work with man, because he has the greatest concentration of force on that level. But I think there are here maybe some, you know, little bit strange ideas that have to be worked through, and maybe correspondences that are not entirely obvious. Okay. But you discover things as you go along, you know, so we can investigate this. But you know, if we want to work with these different kingdoms, we, as a magician, we have to know something about the differentiations of the systemic ethers and where the energy comes from in terms of the cosmic ethers. And we have to be able to evoke those higher energies and pass them through the level of our systemic etheric body, which is appropriate to work with a particular kingdom of nature. It's all very intricate, and the work is specialized. You know, we can't do all things on the planet. DK tells us not to race all over the planet looking for many things to do, but to zero in on something that will be related to the plan and will be useful, and then under the law of limitation, to limit the arena of our service. So this is interesting, and you know, the degree to which we can confirm these speculations, I don't know. It's not established. But interesting that the mineral kingdom is connected with Buddhic energy. And sometimes maybe we find that with certain precious stones, they are suitable for invoking or evoking higher states. Is it possible that there is a gemstone or, you know, some kind of advanced mineral being that will help us in evoke the Buddhic energy within our nature? Maybe it is so. One of the secrets not yet revealed, he says, fortunately, is concerned with the question as to whether light violet is the color of the highest or the lowest of the four, and this will not be revealed for some time to come. But, you know, he seems to say, that light violet pertains to the third. Oh, come on. Systemic ether. Second systemic ether. And that lavender pertains to the first and the highest. Somewhere he gives this, you know. So is it a revelation that he thought when he was writing this he could not give? Because he does seem to say purple 4, violet 3, light violet 2, lavender 1. Let's see. The consideration of these various quaternaries, because it simply says in the rule the 4, so we are invited to apply this idea of the quaternary to a number of different quaternaries, which we have been doing. The consideration of these various quaternaries, which it is necessary that the white magician understand, certainly the higher cosmic ethers in their relation to the lower and the fourfold personality, and maybe even the, you know, some fourfoldness found within the egoic lotus and so forth, and the three rays and their embodiment, you know, that kind of thing, which it is necessary that the white magician understand, and the qualifications which he must possess before it is permitted, he is permitted to carry forward the magical work, leads to the following questions. So, understanding is one thing, and it goes along with recognition, and the other is qualification. That word did not change, that remained the same, but recognition and understanding go together. So we're led to another question. Is there some basic formula of, or proposition which must govern magical activity? You know, you can really tell here that except for the advice as to how to be a really good disciple, DK is definitely writing for the future. And a lot has to be pass through in this transition from the age of Pisces to Aquarius, when everything is so turbulent. It's almost as if the true effective formulas could not be released into such a disrupted and turbulent environment. This question, he says, is of course too general and vague, but until the inclusiveness of the human mind is greater than is now the case, such questions will inevitably be asked. You know, so we think, we, humanity, think inaccurately and without sufficient scope. Kind of wonder, you know, the old saying in the Bible, what is man that thou art mindful of him, you know, speaking to God. And sometimes we can lower the bar and say, what is the aspirant, master, that thou art mindful of him? The aspirant being so relatively stupid. And yet the future of the human being is seen by one who has trodden that way himself. So the master is mindful and takes great patience with the ordinary stupidities found in the aspirant. Somewhere DK kind of lists those stupidities. He has his moment. I forget where it is. Maybe is it in the rules of the road? You know, it might be interesting just to see that word, stupidities. There are five of them. It's not the Destiny of the Nations, and I think I'm right. Well, you know, men are stupid. He seems to say so. A disciple who is not yet full of vision, of a more trained worker who is just learning the ABCs. A public work may, with all his failures and dense stupidities, be doing as well as the older disciple, with his wider knowledge and experience. Well, we're not expected, the three-year-old is expected to do well in terms of being a three-year-old, you know. I'm not sure I can find this, but, and I'm not sure that the word is stupidities. It might be stupidity. And there we're going to find much more. Oh, here it is. It's in the rules of the road, and upon the road the hidden stands revealed. Each sees and knows the villainy of each. And now he defines villainy, okay. So I can find no other word, my brother, to translate the ancient word which designates the unrevealed stupidity, the vileness, and crass ignorance, and the self-interest, which are the distinguishing characteristics of the average aspirant. Well, we've been put in place, haven't we? Because he says we had better all consider ourselves to be average. Otherwise, we're going to fall into the sin of pride, which is very dangerous. So there it was on page 50 in Glamour World Problem. And he doesn't pull any punches there, does he? Unrevealed stupidity, vileness, crassness, ignorance, self-interest. That's all lurking within us and has to be purified. Probably Pluto helping a great deal before the first initiation. Okay, so what is his answer to this question, which is only framed because we have not the mind to frame it otherwise. It's too general, too vague, but okay, he's going to say something. I have, however, given a short reply. I can, however, give a short reply which holds in it the clue to the entire process. When correctly understood, it will govern the method of work and the thought life of the worker in white magic. Is there some basic formula or proposition which governs magical activity? And my answer is this. He says, potencies produce precipitation. That's the whole thing. It's an obvious ponder on this mantra or dictum or revelation or whatever. Potencies produce precipitation. In those words, in those three words, lie the entire story. They sum up the history of the creator and the life story and environment conditions of every human being. According to the energies and forces with which we deal, so will be inevitably the precipitations of our lives. It's like a bit like character is destiny. You know, the Thackeray quote, a thought, a habit, character, and then that precipitation we call destiny. They account for all that is and lie back of the law of rebirth. So we have to look to the potencies to see what kind of precipitation will result. These potencies are driven into activity by the power of thought. So let's just say, so indispensable in the magical process. And hence, in training them to be creators and in teaching them to govern and control their own destinies, the teachers of the race begin with the mind aspect of the aspirant. You know, what are our thoughts? Because our thoughts will precipitate. They emphasize that which will govern the potencies. How will they be directed? Toward what? In what measure? At what time? They deal with that which produces the objective form, which is qualified by these potencies, is energized by them, and which fulfills the purpose of the thinker. So this is the training process of how to use the mind in relation to the potencies to produce precipitation. Mind is the intermediary, producing precipitation. Producing a precipitation from potencies. Okay. They emphasize that which will govern the potencies, direct them, release them. They deal with that which produces the objective form. The mind is so important there, which is qualified by them, by these potencies we possess, is energized by them, and which fulfills the purpose of the thinker. Capital T, I guess it's the soul. Okay. A thinker then is the essential factor. And there's certainly no magic without the thinker. A thinker then is the essential factor, and it will become apparent to you, therefore, as you study these words, just what is going on in the world today. The trend of our modern civilization, in spite of all its mistakes and errors, is to produce thinkers. We are at that point in the Aryan race, in the five of five, the five, fifth sub-race of the fifth root race, when thinkers are being produced. Education, books, travel, in its many and varied forms, enunciations of science and of philosophy, and the driving inner urge, which we call religious, but which is, in fact, the drive towards truth and its mental verification, all these factors have one objective, and that is to produce thinkers. And the soul itself, is known as the thinker with a capital T. Given a real thinker, you have an incipient beginning, creator, and unconsciously at first, but consciously later on, one who will wield power in order to precipitate or cause to emerge objective forms. So, a thinker causes the emergence of objective forms. These forms will either be in line with the divine purpose and plan, and consequently will further the cause of evolution, or they will be animated by personal intent, characterized by a separated selfish purpose, and constitute therefore part of the work of the retroactive forces and the material element. What are those retroactive forces? The Black Lodge, or the Lords of Form. Maybe in the previous solar system is all right to emphasize the form, because it was a personal solar system, dealing, I think, with the development of the personality of the solar logos, but not any longer. So they will, they will be in the nature of black magic. Well, okay. Again, the four appear: the thinker, the potency, and the quality of that potency, and the precipitation. Potencies produce precipitation. That is the one way the Tibetan answers the request for some general statement which applies to the entire magical process. He has interpolated, actually, additional factors. He's interpolated the thinker, the wielder of potencies, and the quality of of those potencies. But this is the whole process, and what's up here that we can think of, and which he has called to our attention. Is there some basic formula or proposition which must govern the magical activity? Well, even though the question is poorly framed and too general and too vague and so forth, Master DK finds a way to answer it in a very pithy manner. Well, we're up to page, I guess, page 552. And we began at 5:39, didn't we? So this is a 3-hour program. I hesitate to make it longer right now. Maybe I would or will. Let's see. And I will find the beginning of it all, if I can. And somewhere it is. There it is. So this is the end of part four, right? Or program number four, and we're going to launch into program number five. And I don't know what was it, 5:52? Something like that. And we'll come down here, and I will copy this. Hopefully, do it correctly before going on to the precipitation of thought forms, which is, the next big subject. So I think I'm justified now. This is the end of number four. And it's 5:39 to, looks like 5:52. Yeah. It is that. 5:39 to 5:52. And it's rule 13. So as the fourth program, we're going to call it 13.1 in three parts. And so here we have number five that we will begin with, and page 552 will be our launching point, and it will be rule 13, but it will be 13 sub 2 for rules of magic on the physical plane. Well, it's a treatise, isn't it? You know, it's ponderous, it's heavy, and only by sitting with it and steeping in it and talking of it and applying those parts of it which can be applied will it really become part of our nature, which is what we want. You know, to absorb all this academically and what we can absorb of it in a practical sense or apply practically, we want to do that too. We are reaching, you know, slowly the end of the book, and there's another 70 pages here. You know, I changed the font to increase a little bit within the within this document, and we're on rule 13, but 14 and 15 have to be discussed. So, yeah, but we've done most of the book. And when I say done, I mean it's not done. The discussion is only opened so that we can think in a deeper way about the life of discipleship and what will make that life successful and what will make of us increasingly white magicians who have a great responsibility coming up, you know, to help bring liberation and to free the prisoners of the planet and not to succumb to the strictly mental magic, which is maybe the magic of form, which will be presented by that group, which does not involve the soul in their magical process. So we have, you know, some many centuries in the age of Aquarius. I don't suspect that any of us is escaping into, well, it's not an escape, but humorously anyway, escaping into mastership in a short time, you know. So we have a lot of work to do in the building of the new age and the executing of the kinds of elevating processes available in the new age, carrying them out so that man can enter the fifth kingdom of nature, Aquarius being so ruled by the fifth ray. Okay, that'll be it for the moment, and then we'll go on as may be possible. See you then soon, and love and many blessings, and let's study hard and meditate deeply and, you know, apply in service what we can. See you soon.